Okay, here's the title. So the main issue which I would like to discuss is has already been mentioned, namely what I am interested in is how small can you make a superconducting particle before you stop calling it superconductor. And in this audience, nobody would make a mistake of assuming that this is the coherence length, which is correct size because we all saw the paper by Anderson. The paper was actually devoted to a different issue and is now sometimes referred to as Anderson's theorem, namely if you take a finite particle with some impurities in it and try to do BCS theory, well, you shouldn't do the pairing of states with opposite momentum because momenta are not eigenvalues here. Instead, you should diagonalize your Hamiltonian of a particle in this potential and use the correct eigenstates and pair them with opposite spins. That was his recipe, and instead of BCS formula for the gap, he got this formula which is different only in one sense. It has discrete sum over all the correct eigenstates in this finite size system. So based on that, he said that, well, as long as the level spacing, this quantum level spacing due to the finite size is much smaller than the gap which we are going to get from this equation, it's all right to replace the sum by an integral, and then we have same superconductivity as before. And in the opposite limit, well, something goes wrong, and probably this means superconductivity breaks down. For 40 years, nobody really cared very much because there were no particles which were that small. But now that we have those, we have to think about a few natural questions. First of all, what exactly we are going to call superconductivity? For once, if you connect some context to the grain and measure conductivity, that is no longer an isolated finite-sized system, so we have to do something better than that. And as soon as you decide what is it we are going to mean by superconductivity, we have to, well, interesting questions are whether or not there is any of that superconductivity left when level spacing, that's my notation for quantum level spacing, is much greater than the superconducting gap of this material, and whether or not there are any interesting finite size corrections in the opposite limit. So I will briefly flash the experiment and what now should be called elementary theory. I will then say what's not quite good about the theory and try to fix it, and then I will answer those two questions. So the experiment which was most stimulating for us, we've already seen the data, so we have a small superconducting particle and two contacts. Particle is isolated with tunneling barriers. So when you apply sufficiently large bias voltage, electrons start tunneling. Sufficiently large, you have to overcome charging energy of this little grain, and you have to overcome the superconducting gap because you're putting a new quasi particle in your system. It takes more energy. And if you kill this gap with magnetic field, you see that this gap shrinks. And those are traces of this first peak. The other traces correspond to other peaks which reflect possibility of tunneling into other states, not the lowest energy state. And once again, an important feature of this data is that there is parity effect, namely number parity effect. If you that was good for the picture with the even number of electrons, where when you put an electron, it has to go to one of the quasi-particle states which have higher energy than the thermal level. And if you already have odd number of particles, there is one unpaired quasi-particle over the gap, you can add another one with giving it somewhat less energy than you normally would. They will pair, form a Cooper pair, and therefore, if there is odd number of electrons, the first peak happens a bit earlier, and then, as the gap shrinks, it goes up. If you do not go to the lowest energy state, you go to the quasi-particle state, you pay this energy delta as expected. And most importantly, those are the other states. So this is roughly level spacing, and this is delta, so they are comparable. In other words, level spacing was so big that you couldn't see any of the superconducting gap here. So here's once again the first couple of theoretical papers, and here let's concentrate on this plane. That's the mean field gap as a function of level spacing. So all that was done in this paper was study of the BCS gap equation as written by Anderson, namely when instead of an integral you have this discrete sum over here. So as you increase level spacing, the mean field gap shrinks to zero, and the rate at which it goes to zero depends on whether or not the number of particles is even or odd. And the ratio of the thresholds was factor of 4, and that's supposed to be how you should observe it. There are two problems with the basic model here. One of them was fixed here. In this paper, in the original paper by Zaikin, Van Delft, and others, levels were to be distant, but in fact they are not. It's an irregularly shaped grain, so levels are supposed to obey Wigner-Dyson statistics. Everything is pretty much known about it. So if you incorporate that, you can no longer draw a picture like this, because all the levels are random and those pictures become random. But the thresholds remain on average, and the ratio of average thresholds is not 4, but even close to 8. So Wigner-Dyson statistics was supposed to enhance this effect of parity in those ultra-small grains. Now, there is another problem, and it was probably partly mentioned in the previous talk, namely, there is no way you can measure this. You do not measure mean field gap in experiment. What you would normally measure would be excitation gap, which is a physically observable quantity. You can do that, for instance, by looking at specific heat. Now, if you take a perfectly normal grain of finite size, all the levels are discrete, so whenever you want to create excitation, there is a little gap, which is in those grains of the order of the superconducting gap. So you can never distinguish one from another by looking at the excitation spectrum. In a more theoretical language, mean field theory is great, but it's an approximation. And in order to improve it, you should think about fluctuations of this order parameter near the mean field value. And in precisely this regime, where level spacing is comparable to the gap, you discover that fluctuations are not small. So, if I hope convinced you, you cannot measure a mean field gap, what can you do about it? What is it I'm going to call superconductivity in this little grain? Depending on what you do in experiment, you would most probably be interested in different quantities. The experiments so far were based on this Coulomb blockade phenomenon, where you get tunneling as long as you overcome charging energy plus perhaps this gap energy. So basically you study the energies of the ground state of the system, assuming your temperature is sufficiently low. So our suggestion was to, for the purpose of this talk, to declare the superconductivity, this parity effect. Namely, you subtract from the energy of odd charge state average of the energies of neighboring even charge states. Why is that good? Well, suppose we take a large superconductor with level spacing going to zero, then your odd charge state carries one, and paired with the particle that carries extra energy delta compared to the even charge state, so this amounts to precisely delta P, the parameter for superconductivity I'm going to be using, equal to delta. That's good. In normal metal, delta is zero, you get zero. So advantage of this compared to mean field gap is that this is something you can at least hope to measure. So how do we calculate that?
Excuse me, can I raise the point as a practical thing? When you talk about these energies of these different numbers, you just are ignoring the Coulomb energy, which is the biggest energy,
right.
And if you make any error in that, you can't make these measures?
Certainly. That was under the assumption that Coulomb energy is an additional term in your energy.
Well, theoretically it is, but it's
sure.
A measure.
Okay. There is an important issue. Well, it was definitely demonstrated in the two-dimensional Coulomb blockade system that, yes, Coulomb energy fluctuates, and it seems to fluctuate a bit more than it should theoretically, and we don't precisely understand that. There is no reason to believe that those fluctuations have anything to do with parity. So I'm still hoping that by looking at even odd spacings, you can extract the quantity that I'm interested in. Okay. Yes, and in 3D, as far as I know, there are no measurements like this. So, and theoretically, it seems very plausible that their fluctuations would be much smaller. But we don't know that yet. So how do we calculate this parity effect in ground state energies? We use the same Hamiltonian, the simplest one you can think of that would capture the essential physics here. Namely, you allow your electrons to have some energies, and those energy levels, I've drawn them equidistant. They don't have to be. None of what I'm going to tell you about will be affected. And you add pairing term, some attractive interaction which moves those Cooper pairs around between different levels. And that's the term that will be responsible for the superconductivity. So now that we have this delta P parameter which define the superconductivity for our purposes, let's play a little game and let's try to do perturbation theory on that Hamiltonian. First of all, let's kill the interaction and see what happens to the ground state energy. Those are non-interacting electrons. It's very simple. You start with two L electrons, you add another one, it goes to L plus first state. You add yet another one, it goes to the same state with opposite spin, so same energy. As you can see, the additions of energies are equal, so when you do this discrete second derivative, the result is zero. That's good. We didn't have any superconductivity, at least we didn't expect without interactions. Let's try to add some, and let's try to do this in the first order perturbation theory in this term, which means let's just simply take expectation value over the ground state, and that gives us a simple result. To the first order, interaction amounts to each electron interacting with this constant G to the electron in the same state and opposite spin. So when you add odd electron, interactions do not affect this increase in energy because this odd electron has nobody to interact with. It goes to an empty state. The next electron will go to the state which is already filled with one electron with opposite spin. It will interact with that. You will get correction minus G to that energy. So when you construct that to my favorite formula, you get some contribution, G over 2. Well, we're about to proclaim that this is the parity effect which we wanted, but it's not quite true. First of all, even if I take repulsive interactions, I'll get something, and we know that hardly has anything to do with superconductivity. And secondly, even if we didn't know about that, we'd say, well, this doesn't look like superconductivity. Superconductivity is supposed to be something expressed in terms of gap, not some obscure microscopic interaction parameter G, which nobody knows about. So something is wrong here. And what's wrong is that we were too simplistic in this description. We did not take into account the fact that interactions are actually normalized. This is well known. I will just briefly outline how you can do it for two reasons. First, it's interesting to how the result will come out. And secondly, you have to make sure what you know was known for grand canonical ensemble where number of particles is not being strictly followed. And it's nice to see that this doesn't matter. So suppose we want to scatter a pair of particles from state k to state k prime. You can go either directly, or we can go through some virtual state in the second order, and you get the denominators. If you sum up overall the energies, you replace some of the integrals and that integral is logarithmic. So there are logarithmic renormalizations to the interaction constants. Well, since second order diverges logarithmically, we know what to do. We have to do proper renormalization procedure. And basically, it's sufficient to just cut the band by, say, factor of 2, remove high energy states, replace their effect by renormalization of this type, then do it again and again and again. And the summation of all those little renormalizations amounts to solving this simple differential equation with the obvious boundary condition that you start at some bandwidth with bare constant G. So after you've done that, the result is rather well known. A renormalized interaction is enhanced. And there is this 1 minus log in denominator. Now, minus is important. For repulsive interaction, that would have been a plus, and the physics would have been very different. G would have been decreasing as you go to low energies. In attractive case, G is increasing, and at some point, something bad happens, this denominator becomes 1. That's when bandwidth becomes of the order of what we now call gap, superconducting gap delta. And, well, that is how superconductivity happens. Your ground state is no longer a good starting point for this physics. You have to rethink your ground state, and this is BCS theory. But suppose now level spacing was greater than delta. Then this denominator is never 0. So you just stop your renormalizations as soon as you reach the lowest energy scale in this problem, and that's it. You're done. If you do that, you get this answer for the renormalized interaction constant. It's somewhat bigger than it was, but it's fine. Okay, since this is it, let's substitute it into our perturbation formula, and we get the answer. This answer is much better than the one I showed you, just 1/2 of an interaction constant, because this no longer depends on microscopic parameters of this problem. It only depends on the observable things such as level spacing and the gap. There is a qualitative new feature compared to mean field theory. Mean field theory would have told you that at finite level spacing your superconductivity is gone. That's it. Here, nothing happens at any particular level spacing. More than that, this parameter actually grows when you increase level spacing. I do not believe this growth is particularly important feature, but what is important, well, that's because delta epsilon level spacing is a natural measure of energy here, natural unit of energy. But what is important is that it never goes to 0. Even though mean field solution already vanished and would have predicted you that you are in a perfectly normal state. There's a little remark if anybody's interested. Wigner-Dyson fluctuations will not affect this epsilon. That comes pretty much from the initial state. It will affect this one, but those will be smaller corrections because it's just a number in the argument of a logarithm. That was somewhat hand-waving discussion. You can do much more rigorous one, and in the process you will get the opposite limiting case, which is much more difficult to deal with, namely when level spacing is much smaller than the gap. And this more rigorous approach is based on path integral. Let me not explain you path integral in all detail, just to mention more important features, namely first of all, this technique will calculate the grand partition function, which means you do not conserve number of particles. The quantity we are interested in is ground state energy for a fixed number of particles. So how is this grand partition function useful to us? Well, we are interested only in the ground state, so it's natural for us to do zero temperature limit. And at zero temperature, grand partition function is dominated by one term. First of all, it will be ground state energy for any number of particles, and then you will pick the one that minimizes energy minus chemical potential times number of particles. And if you can now change number of particles, you will scan different values of N, and you will potentially be able to find out what's your ground state energy is. There's a little problem with that. Namely, we are studying parity effect, which basically says that physicists say that all charged states have some extra energy. As a result, this energy is always lower, higher than one of the neighboring energies. So this procedure will never give you automatically any state with the odd number of electrons. They all have higher energy than the neighbors. Well, what to do? You just make one simple observation. Suppose you include interactions sort of perturbatively, and well, we saw that the interaction term only moves pairs around. So if you have one unpaired electron sitting somewhere, you can never put a pair here, you can never remove a pair here, because this state is occupied by precisely one, not zero, not two electrons. So for the purposes of changing of energy due to interactions, this level just does not exist. So you can just by hand remove one level and do the same procedure as for even number of states, and then add the energy of this level by hand. So this is pretty much what we've done. Well, speaking of kitchens, this is what exactly we were doing. It's all the usual ingredients. We start with Haber-Statonovich transformation, which splits this interaction terms into two quadratic terms. Then we trace out electronic degrees of freedom, and we end up with the path integral for this order parameter as a function of time. Then you do mean field approximation. You recover, of course, the known mean field gap equation. And finally, you expand your action near these mean field solutions to take a look at the contribution of the fluctuations to this grand partition function. If you go through that procedure, first of all, for small grains, well, level spacing is much greater than delta. You get pretty much the same result as what I have qualitatively described. I mean, it's satisfying, but not really unexpected. For large grains, when we could be, well, when we were interested in corrections due to the small level space and some finite size corrections to the superconductivity, well, the result was as follows. From the mean field, you get some finite suppression of the gap. It's proportional to the level spacing, and that could have been easily derived from the paper by Zaykin, because they studied these mean field equations in every detail. When you look at the fluctuations, for some reason which I do not understand, to this order in level spacing over delta, fluctuations vanish. That seems to be a rather general result, as it was confirmed later on numerically for not only ground state but for some excited states. I don't know where it comes from, but I do know what it means. When you plot delta P as a function of level spacing, so as you start increasing level spacing, starting from very very large grain, and then decreasing its size, so level spacing increases, your gap first decreases. And if you continue that, you will get one delta and Zaykin's curve. Well, that will be some kind of average curve for mean field gap going down to zero. But this is not a mean field theory. There are fluctuations. In the opposite limit, fluctuations are large. They give this contribution, which is actually growing. So somewhere in the middle, there must be a minimum. Well, that's all we've been able to do. And just as a final word, there are a couple of papers which appeared a little later, which numerically solved this Hamiltonian and plotted precisely the same quantity that I've been just pointing at, this delta P in units of delta, and they do show the same qualitative behavior, and they've been able to check this asymptotic. They appear to be correct. Thank you.
But can you make some comment on your starting Hamiltonian that is already renormalized in some way? You just have some attractive interaction, right? And instantaneous. And the superconductivity is caused by the fact that that's marginally relevant under scaling. But there must be, there are lots of things that are nominally irrelevant, but presumably in a small grain, how it flows away to zero. It could be important.
Is that a sensible question? Yeah, it certainly is a sensible question, and there are other terms. It just included the one that gives us the correct catastrophe and have included its contribution. It is generally believed that those other terms, they will give you all sorts of important things, such as Fermi liquidity normalizations and so on, which could have been included in those levels. Not that we've done it rigorously for a very small system. No, but we think they are somewhere in those levels. That's basically the assumption.
I'm surprised that just doing Gaussian fluctuations is really not for a small system. They would tell us that there were retarding effects that you don't have to worry about.
Tunneling such as between degenerate minima.
Right, well, you're still covering on your first of tunneling for the symmetry here of the test.
Right. For each winding number in that Hamiltonian, you have only one minimum. I don't think you can tunnel between different winding numbers. No, the path integral is already written for the canonical sum. That's why I have winding numbers. But I don't think you can tunnel from one to another. I do not believe so. And technically, when you go from one winding number to another, they're all very much alike, but they sort of live in different spaces. You cannot make one fluctuation do those things, but maybe I do not entirely understand your question. No, of course they are included.
Right.
They are included, but they're all very much alike.
Right.
And, I don't think so. I think Gaussian fluctuations will destroy it just fine. Well, the truthful answer is no. We thought only about Gaussian fluctuations.
Can you repeat the question and the answer?
Can you repeat that?
The question was whether or not we've included fluctuations of the phase. I understand it was pretty much the same question as the previous one.
And the answer?
No. Charging energy was not included into that picture. It was assumed that it's an additive term,
right,
which you add to that within the standard, but not quite obvious constant interaction model, where you just write q squared over 2c. Corrections would have been terms like those you asked about, and they were not included.
I think there's some confusion. Maybe it's not. This is a model in which the number of particles is conserved. I mean, the model that Katya wrote down had a conserved number of particles.
Yes.
Now, then, there's the question of how you solve that model and what approximations you meant.
Right.
In the weak coupling thing, there was a perturbation expansion. You certainly weren't assuming anything. The phase is processing all over the place. On the strong coupling side, near the very left-hand edge, you're in some sense perturbing about a solution in which there's a well-defined phase and then averaging over all the phase, if you wish, and you can question whether something's been left out or not. But in any case, the numerical calculations, for example, that Berger and I did, or that Cantaloni did, made no such approximation. It was basically numerical solutions of a truncated version of the equation, and we certainly are working in a space of definite particle number, not a space of definite phase, and it certainly agrees, as well as we can see, with the calculation that you made. Now, there could be errors, there certainly could be errors that were exponential. All my faith claims to get is the first order term, I guess, correctly, which is this linear term, and it may or may not be higher order terms, but certainly everything is exactly the way he predicted. Numerical calculations only look exactly what
I think part of the question was the phrase Gaussian fluctuation often means ignoring winding numbers.
The sum of the winding numbers was in that calculation.
Fine. So it's just
but it was sort of a trivial thing which